Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Since John Dewey laid out the predicate for broad-scale societal education at the turn of the last century, things have remained pretty much the same. Sure, we've tinkered around the edges, scaled up, and done some experimentation, but today it truly does seem as if we're simply rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. In a world where the collected wisdom of mankind is a mouse click away, where the disparity in learning ability and style is wider than ever, and where the need for education has never been clearer, we really do need a whole new paradigm. Today we're joined by a man who may very well be the progenitor of that paradigm shift. He is Sal Khan. He is the founder, administrator, and faculty of the Khan Academy. He has 3 degrees from MIT, where he served as student body president, and an MBA from Harvard, where he was also class president. He's going to be here in the Napa Valley this weekend, and it is my pleasure to welcome Sal Khan to the program today. Sal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us how you got started with this. You are educating over 1 million students a month. You've got about 18 million views on your website. How did the Khan Academy get started?
Yeah, and actually those numbers, I mean, we've been growing so fast that those numbers are moving target. Now it's 2 million students a month, and I think we've had 50 million something views. But it started very almost happenstance. I was tutoring my cousins. I was a hedge fund analyst after business schools. Rewind to 2004, I had some cousins visit me in Boston. I was in Boston at the time, and they were from New Orleans. And one of my cousins, Navia, it turned out that she was having trouble with math. So I said, hey, when you go back to New Orleans, why don't I tutor you? She was up for it. So we kind of did this thing over speakerphone, and we used Instant Messenger and Yahoo Doodle and all of these things to try to work with each other. It worked out well for her, so I started tutoring her brothers, other family members. You can imagine I had a day job, so once I had about 15 or 20 of these kind of family, friends, and all over the country, I said, there's got to be a better way to do this, especially, I don't want to have to do the same lecture multiple times, and it became hard scheduling and all of that, and I had a buddy who said, why don't you record some of your lessons on YouTube, and I was immediately dismissive. I said, that's for dogs on skateboards. That's not for serious mathematics. But I got over the idea. It wasn't my idea, and I gave it a shot. And, two things happened. My cousins said that they liked me better on YouTube than in person, and other people started watching the videos. And I kept making the videos. Fast forward to 2009. It was a hobby up until then, a significant hobby, but the site at that point had so many viewers and it was reaching so many people that I had trouble focusing on my day job, so I quit. So we've now started the not-for-profit Khan Academy. It has 2,200 videos on everything. Right now, all the videos have been made by me, but it has everything from basic arithmetic all the way to biology and calculus and chemistry. But we're now building it into kind of a bigger organization that, besides videos, has software exercises. And our goal is to really be a free virtual school.
And when did you realize that you had stumbled on something that was really going to radically shift education?
There was a bunch of different moments where there was, a small realization that there was something here. The early realization is just when I started getting letters, just with the first few hundred videos that I had made, where some people would just write, thank you, but some people would write, this helped me pass algebra, or for the first time, I feel like I understand mathematics, or I now want to become an engineer, whatever. So immediately that got in my head, wow, these are videos are there. Even if I get hit by a bus, these videos can keep teaching and keep reaching these people who are having this kind of almost life-changing moment just because of something silly like YouTube videos. And you fast forward a little bit more, and I started getting letters from teachers saying, look, you've already given a lecture on the basic trigonometric functions, or you've already given a lecture on how to graph a function, or whatever it might be. And so I, as the teacher, the teachers who emailed me, they said, well, I don't have to give that lecture anymore. And so what I'm doing is I'm telling the students to watch your videos at their own pace, at their own time, pause and repeat, mainly at home. And then that frees up class time to actually do problems, to actually do projects. And so just even that's a very small change. in terms of what you're doing, but it's a huge change in terms of what turns the classroom into. It instead of a bunch of kids sitting passively in a room, you have kids now who are interacting with each other. The lecture is now at everyone's own pace. You don't have 30 kids all being fed the same lecture at the same pace. So that started to hint that there's something here that could be done at the actual school system. And then when we got funding and we've built out, we're now 8 people. We've built out an engineering team and we started working on the software, or I guess improving the software. I'd started the software early on for my cousins. Actually out here in Silicon Valley, Los Altos came up to us and said, what would you do if you could do anything with a fifth grade class? And we said, we'd have every student working at their own pace, using the software, using the videos, and the teacher would just get really good data, really good dashboard on where every student is, and they will they will, instead of giving a lecture, they will focus on the students who are stuck, who are having problems, or even pair up students so they can teach each other. And it'll also free up a lot of time for the teacher to lead projects and whatever else. So that's all of these have been random steps that have made us realize, wow, there's actually something pretty transformational here.
How much of what's transformational is as a result of the method and technology, and how much, though, is really about you as a teacher and the way you have done this?
It's a mix of both. I'm not the first person to put videos on YouTube. This has been done. Even some major institutions, MIT, Stanford, that they've put many of their lectures up on YouTube before I put the first one up. I think we got traction with students more than some of these other efforts have, just because of there are these 10-minute videos, although they still cover everything. They have more 10-minute videos instead of fewer 90-minute videos. And I think to some degree it might be my style resonates a bit with students because it's more conversational. It's not someone at a whiteboard or a chalkboard talking to a class. When you watch Khan Academy videos, I think it feels like we're sitting next to each other and we're working on a shared whiteboard, and I'm kind of like your neighbor or your older brother or your younger brother, whoever, and we're working together on things. So I think that's helped kind of resonate things. But it's also a lot of due to the just where we are in history, in terms of technology. All of this stuff is now, all of a sudden, even when MIT started making their video platform, I'm sure they spent much, much, much more money just to serve their own videos and whatever else. I could leverage YouTube. Now that we have our software can reach millions of students. We don't have to run our own data center. We don't have to do any of that stuff. We're running on Google's platform. So the technology is right there now that a relatively small group of people can do, can build and iterate something that can reach millions of people.
I want to come back to something you touched on before, which is that this, in many ways, to the extent that it's effective, flips the classroom around. That suddenly the homework becomes the lecture, and what goes on in the classroom is entirely different.
Yeah, and you know, to some degree, that's almost, you know, those were those first letters that I got from teachers saying, hey, look, you made lectures. Why should the teacher redo that lecture, and especially because it's not going to be at the student's pace, and it's when everyone's in a classroom, and it can be stressful and all of that. Why doesn't the teacher or the classroom leverage the fact that you have 30 people in the room and not make it a passive experience, make it an interactive experience by actually doing problems, by actually working with each other? But to some degree, now that we've added the software component, it's now, you know, flipping was almost stage one. Stage two now is whether you're at home or you're in the classroom, everyone is watching videos and doing problems all at their own pace, and the teacher is just getting constant real-time data, and the teacher can decide what makes the most sense.
One of the things you did in building this is you got real-time data in terms of how long the attention span was for people watching these videos.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. If on YouTube, and once again, this is just a feature YouTube has if you upload videos, is that they'll tell you how well people paid attention to your video relative to other videos, and they measure that by whether people dropped off, whether people stopped watching your video relative to other videos of that length. And so all of a sudden that's kind of a bit of a holy grail of lecturing, of education, because now you can actually tell, wow, you know, that video all of a sudden at minute five, people drop off, and that's because I said the word orthogonality and I didn't define the word or whatever. Or maybe I didn't explain the basics well enough in the other videos. So all of a sudden it allows someone like myself to look at the data and iterate on it. And now we're starting to keep track of more data to see where did people pause, where did people repeat. Did it help people to watch a video? Did it help them do the exercises more? Did it not? And in that case, maybe we should do another video or whatever. Or when are they watching the video, or how are they watching the video? So the data that we're able to kind of keep track of is kind of unheard of, in especially in education.
And there's also the ability to drill down into other videos. If there are phrases or concepts within a video that people don't understand, there's another video to explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all had the experience sitting in a college lecture hall, and the professor says something, some word or concept that you're like, yeah, I kind of remember learning that last year, and you kind of understand it, but you really wish you could have paused the professor and then gone and watched the professor from last year where you learned it the first time, really make sure you understood that more basic concept and then come back. Obviously, you can't do that in a live lecture hall, but it's very easy to do it with on-demand video.
Talk about the way mastery is a goal that is inherent in this concept.
When I started making, most people, you know, the videos are what made Khan Academy known, but I started a very primitive version of the exercises for my cousins before even the first video. And the mindset was, when I was tutoring my cousin Nadia, whenever she was entering seventh grade, whenever I asked, it was kind of like she knew a bunch of stuff kind of well. She knew nothing really well. Whenever I'd ask her a question, I'd say, -3 - 2. She wouldn't say -5. She would say -5, and I'd say, are you sure? And so I wanted to give her exercises so that I could make sure that she mastered the underlying concepts and she could answer them with confidence. And so I wrote this little exercise generator would generate as many questions as she needed, kind of these random exercises, and it would keep giving her one type of exercise until she got 10 in a row. And that was, you know, my view of what, that's a decent view of mastery, instead of 90% right or 80% right or 70% right that the traditional school system does, because you're still going to get, you're still missing 10% or 20% or 30% of that model. I said, 10 in a row, that's kind of a pretty high bar. And once I started doing that with my cousins, they really did get more confident. They didn't have this, you know, I'm a B-plus student the whole life, so I'm a little unsure about a lot of things. And now I realize, you know, we've incorporated that into our software. It's a lot more sophisticated now. But this idea has been around forever. It's called mastery-based learning. I didn't call it that at first, but it's been around for 100 years at least. But the reality is, it's probably been around thousands of years. If you wanted to learn to juggle knives, you wouldn't learn to juggle balls or oranges only halfway and then try knives. You would master the oranges or the whatever else first. And so we're just applying the same thing to mathematics. It's actually kind of crazy that the opposite is what is happening in most classes right now. People try to learn a concept, they take an exam. On that exam, people miss 10%, 20% of the exam. So the assessment was given, it's been identified you have a weakness. Despite that, the whole class moves on to a more advanced topic that's going to build on those weaknesses. So you end up having these Swiss cheese gaps through your career. And I think that's why there's a math class that everyone gets to where they just can't do it anymore, because those gaps have gotten so big that they can't build on them anymore.
One of the things that you emphasize is that these videos and this learning is not the be-all and end-all of the educational process, that it works best as a tool about the basics in conjunction with what's going on in the classroom. And you're experimenting with this now in Los Altos.
Yeah. You know, there's this constant stress, especially in math education, but I think in probably science, probably education generally, do you focus more on kind of the traditional core skills, the type of things that would be measured on standardized tests, or do you focus on more of the project-based, interactive, peer-to-peer or whatever exploratory type of learning? And there's always been this kind of battle, and you have different camps. And what we're saying is, look, we can do the core skills now really, really, really efficiently. We can do it with the videos, the exercises, the data. We can have peers teaching each other. And so what it does is it doesn't de-emphasize the other stuff. It actually frees up time to do the other stuff. So what we're seeing in Los Altos is the two fifth grade classes and the two seventh grade classes that are doing this for about 20 to 30 minutes, so about half of their math class, they're able to accomplish so much on the core skills part of it, the type of stuff that is going to be measured on standardized tests or whatever, that they're way ahead of where you would expect fifth or seventh graders to be. And so it allows them to spend a lot of time on project-based learning, on interacting with each other, and just doing other interesting stuff.
How do you see this being scaled up? If everything in Los Altos works well, how can this be scaled up to the size that it could be effective throughout the country?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is the technology is already scaled up to some degree. We've been looking at our data, and it looks like there's about 1,000 classrooms in the country, or maybe it's in the world, that are already using it in some way, shape, or form. So we have 2 million students using it a month. We said, look, are there groups of 30 students who have a coach? We have this idea called a coach, and this is essentially what the teachers are, and then the coach can see all the data on the students. And it looks like there's about 1,000 of these groups that are fairly active. So the technology can actually, any classroom in the world tomorrow, if they have, and these are two big things, if they have internet access and they have decent access to computers, they could do this. But in our mind, we want to, you know, we're focused on Los Altos as opposed to the other 900-something schools, is because we want to make sure that we get the model right and we can point people to this model. So what we're going to do, we have some initial data from Los Altos, which shows very promising. It's definitely not doing any damage to the kids, and it seems like they're actually way ahead of grade level, but we'll get more data on that. We're going to roll out more in Los Altos, probably close to, we're trying to sort it out, but it might be close to district-wide in several of the grades. We're probably going to do this in another 10 to 15 schools and school districts over the next year. And our goal in those districts is we want to do it in different use cases, some in private schools, some in public schools, some in charter schools, different demographics, some in underserved communities, some in communities that are doing quite okay. And just make sure that it works in all of those situations and they're unambiguous successes. And I think once you do that, you can point the rest of the world to look at these cases. And then I think to some degree parents will just say, gee, I need to have this for my kid in our community. And then it'll kind of, hopefully there'll be kind of a bottoms-up groundswell to have it happen.
Are there motivational and feedback loops that are either currently built into or will be built into the software as this evolves?
Yeah, I think the big thing, you know, even when I started off the primitive version for my cousins, I mean, instant feedback's a big deal. I mean, you know, right now you do your homework out of the textbook, you get no feedback until you go the next morning, and then you might review some of your homework, and you might do all the questions wrong. And I think as humans, especially while you're learning something, you need pretty instant feedback to know how you're doing. And so early on, even the primitive version, you obviously kept track of your streak. You knew whether you got it right or wrong. I have these energy points that I threw in very early on, and now our team has really built up on that. So there's all this kind of game mechanics. You get badges. Some of the badges are for academic achievement. Some of them are things like showing persistence, that you're really trying to achieve something that is that's taking you a little bit of while, but you're sticking at it. Soon you're going to see badges for helping peers. So yeah, we're you know, the biggest complaint we've had from parents is that their kids actually get addicted to it. So
what does this mean for reworking and reexamining the classroom and student teacher ratios, and how it affects perhaps how it will affect the economics of schools?
Yeah, you know, the student teacher ratios, obviously the fewer students per teacher the better, but we think that the more relevant ratio is not student to teacher, but student to valuable time with the teacher ratio. So in a traditional classroom, a teacher might spend, I don't know, 30% of their time lecturing, 30% of their time grading and writing assignments, maybe 20% of the time doing administrative tasks. And so I don't know what I have left over. I wasn't doing the math in my head, but it's like 10% left over to actually sit next to students and talk to students. And frankly, a lot of that time is probably spent, you know, classroom management, maybe reprimanding some of the kids who are a little rowdier or whatever else. And so they're really not spending a lot of direct human-to-human time with most of the students. In the model that we're seeing in Los Altos is the teachers are actually spending about 100% of their time, because they're not giving lectures, they're not grading papers and writing assignments. They are essentially, every minute of their time is spent mentoring students and directly interacting with them. And so, you know, what we say is it's kind of increased the student to time with the teacher ratio by, I mean, it sounds crazy, but by a factor of 10 or maybe more. So that's what we care about. You know, we try to stay out of the what's the optimal student-teacher ratio or how mm-hmm. many, you know, using this type of model, how many students can a teacher teach? We don't know the answer to that. We're experimenting. Our goal is, given the resources at hand, how do you maximize the amount of learning?
And, of course, the other component of it that goes with the teaching above and beyond the videos themselves are the tutoring component of this, and what you talk about is kind of a global classroom.
Yeah, you know, just yesterday I was in one of the classrooms in Los Altos, and it really, and I don't want to swamp them, but they like it when people visit and watch the classroom, but it's really amazing to see a classroom like that, how interactive it is, and how many of the peers are actually tutoring each other, and often pretty well, like probably better than an adult could have taught the peers, so they really understand what's going on in their friends' heads, and so there's no, you know, so you have this idea of a peer within a classroom can teach each other, but look, they're all using the same system. It's all web-based. There's no reason why you can't have a student in St. Helena who knows algebra tutor a kid in Mountain View or in Los Angeles or New York who is having trouble with algebra. And then you can even record that session for safety purposes, but also so that other students could access it in the future. Or it could be something as simple as message boards. If someone has a question, other people will answer it. And you're going to see a lot more of that on Khan Academy over the next 6 months.
What, if any, and obviously there's a lot of enthusiasm for this, what, if any, pushback have you gotten either from teachers, parents, or other interested communities to all of this?
Yeah, you know, I think the main pushback comes less from people looking at what we're doing, but more from, you know, sometimes there's a headline or whatever that makes it, you know, will the school system be demolished by Khan Academy? So, you know, that's not an exact headline, but essentially these fairly bold headlines, and I think people sometimes have a knee-jerk reaction against, these solutions that are magical solutions, and they're rightfully skeptical of things like that, because there have been many things like this in many fields where, you know, they just kind of, they're flash in the pans and they die out. But amongst the group, the teachers who have actually seen what we're doing, they realize that what we're doing isn't about replacing teachers. It isn't about turning the students into robots or the classroom into kind of an assembly line. It's actually the opposite, that the classroom right now is an assembly line, and we're trying to make it self-paced. And to a large degree, it makes teaching a lot more fun, because you get to do more creative things. It's less lecturing. The teachers we've talked to all are pretty excited. If anything, we're getting more interest for adopting it than we can handle right now.
Is there a difference in the way it works for other subjects that are a little more subjective than mathematics?
Yeah, we're experimenting with that. The video library already goes into some of those subjects. There's videos on history, which is, frankly, it's a subjective. Sometimes it's not taught as a subjective, but it should be a subjective subject. And we'll see. You know, I think in a place like history, at minimum, something like the Khan Academy, once again, just like math, it can cover it can do a lot of the blocking and tackling. It can make sure students have at least a scaffold of what we know are the facts, or a scaffold of events, that they at least have the basics. We can eventually build an exercise library that at least makes sure that, you know, students can perform well on kind of the standardized tests, the AP tests, or whatever. And we think that'll do the same thing that it's doing for math. It would free time for actual conversations in class about, you know, actual debates, about actually understanding what happened at a more nuanced level. So I think in things like history, in grammar, it can work really well. In things like creative writing, I think there's something that we could do. It'll probably be very different than what we're doing now. But I think our goal, and, you know, we're still in the early days as an organization, our goal is to constantly see what can we take and make it efficient. You know, even in Los Altos, we've been seeing some of the projects that the kids have been working on. They're working on one right now where they're tiling tiles on a thing, and they're going to be graded based on how pretty their tiles are and how efficiently they were able to do it, and the different tiles cost different amounts of money and all of that, so they have to optimize it. And so we've already started, hey, that's a pretty cool project they're doing. Is there some way that we can implement that in software so that anyone who uses Khan Academy can do that project, even if they don't have access to the materials? So we want to do the same thing in other subjects. Well, look, this is going on in a lot of classrooms. Can we somehow put that into the online world so that anyone has access to that experience?
You mentioned that this is all available free now. What is the economic model upon which is this is built, and what does it look like going forward?
We're giving everything for free, and that's our intention, to always give it away for free. We are a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, and our economic model is hopefully for the foreseeable future foundation supported. That's plan A, I guess. You know, plan B is, well, plan A is actually foundation plus user supported. So, hey, if people use Khan Academy, they're getting value out of Khan Academy. We do hope that they donate to us. But from the foundation side, I think, you know, we all know there's billions of dollars being spent in education these days on an annual basis. And we think we're probably the most scalable way to do it, that especially when you think about online resources. We can reach everyone in the world, and our operating budget is less than a medium-sized preschool. So the other thing is that these resources will continue to teach even when we stop developing them. So they could teach, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of students 10, 20 years from now. So hopefully the foundation support, the user support, can keep us going. If that doesn't work, we'll have to go to plan C, D, or E, which, you know, we never want to put advertising on our site and stuff like that. But, you know, hopefully we'll always be able to stick around in some way.
One aspect of this, beyond your videos and what you've been able to do, is proprietary.
The videos themselves actually aren't proprietary. We have them under Creative Commons, non-commercial attribution, share-alike license, which means that if anyone wants to use them for a non-commercial purpose, they can, as long as they say where it came from, and you know, they're not charging for it. So they're not proprietary in that sense. The software also... some of the software is open, some of the software is kind of the property of the Khan Academy, but still our view is everyone should be able to use it in a non-commercial way in whatever way they see fit. So for the most part, we're trying to be as non-proprietary as possible.
And you've even had Bill Gates out there proselytizing for it.
Yeah, it turns out, and he's one of our major supporters. This was the fall of last year. It just turned out that he actually, I didn't even know about it. He was speaking in front of an audience of 2,000 people at the Aspen Institute, and he was asked what is he excited about in education, and he just started saying how he uses a site called the Khan Academy for himself and for his children, and how he thought it was wonderful, and all of these things. And you can imagine it was a bit of a surreal moment for me. And since then, you know, we've met, and he's turned into one of our biggest supporters, and frankly, one of our biggest cheerleaders. So it's been pretty amazing.
And talk about, for you, what it has been like to go from a hedge fund analyst to somebody that is considered an education guru right now.
Yeah, you know, as you could, well, the good thing is it was kind of a gradual transition, because I was doing the Khan Academy for 4 years, kind of part-time, while I was the analyst at a hedge fund. But it's, it's before you make a jump like that, it's always pretty scary. You're giving up a career that you've obviously invested a lot of, you know, time and energy and all the rest in. But once you do it, it's worked out pretty well. A lot, and you can imagine a lot more. There's a lot more goodwill towards you when you're teaching people for free than when you're just trying to, you know, generate alpha for investors.
Sal Khan, he's the founder and executive director of the Khan Academy. Sal, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Great, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.